You're listening to CKMS News on CKMS 102.7 FM in Waterloo, Ontario. This program is a part of the Local Journalism Initiative Grant Program and is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Government of Canada, and the CKMS Newsroom. You can access the recordings of the show on radiowaterloo.ca/news or on the National Local Journalism Initiative website, canada-info.ca. I'm your host, Shalaka Jadhav. Robin Burns and Elizabeth Barbary are academic workers in the Department of Recreation and Leisure Studies at the University of Waterloo. In early 2021, they published their article, Placemaking as Unmaking, Settler Colonialism, Gentrification, and the Myth of Revitalized Urban Spaces, and took up the example of Gowdy's Lane, a corridor in downtown Kitchener which stretches from Queen Street North to Ontario Street. Their work on Gowdy's Lane came out of Robin's dissertation research, where Robin foregrounded her interest in anti-gentrification with support from her supervisor, Lisbeth, in thinking through the related theory and methodologies. During the pandemic, when public spaces have seen increased use, they've also seen increased surveillance as a consequence of placemaking. So how public are these public spaces? Together, Robin and Lisbeth talk through the growing tensions between public space, public memory, and how colonialism engages at those intersections by walking through their methods, findings, and presenting key reflections on Gowdy's Lane. So before we dive into our conversation, can you introduce yourselves to our listeners?
So my name's Robin Burns. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Waterloo in Department of Recreation and Leisure Studies. And I research gentrification, which probably is best summed up as how communities change and more importantly, who they're changing for. And then I wrote this paper with my supervisor, Dr. Elizabeth Burberry, who's on the call, and in relation to sort of some of the conversations we've had and are still having about the places we move through and how they're changing. And like I said, in particular, who they're changing for and some of the inequities that we see bound up in that.
Yeah, I'm Elizabeth Burberry, and I'm an associate professor at the University of Waterloo in the Faculty of Health. And Robin and I just think together, read together, and engage in the world in ways that try to make it more liberatory for people.
So can you share a little bit about how placemaking is defined or engaged with for a public audience and why challenging that definition is important to you and in turn in the literature as an academic?
So placemaking in its sort of intended practice is meant to be something that's participatory and community led and really a bottom up process. So as opposed to like top down hierarchical power, making all the decisions about what a place looks like, the sort of spirit behind placemaking is liberatory or at least inclusive and moving and representational and moving towards identifying areas of sometimes it's called blight or underuse, which are, again, it's who gets to call a place underused or blighted. That's a good question. But identifying a something problematic typically is where it starts rather than asset-based. So it's an empty wall, it's an empty lot, and trying to make it more useful, but also more meaningful to people in those places. So that's the idea of making a space into a place. So a place that has connections and something that people feel connected to. And then why sort of challenge that? Maybe I guess my concern was seeing this sort of the sort of spirit of placemaking, which I think has some potential, seeing it increasingly co-opted for ultimately for gentrification, for sort of the unquenchable progress of cities towards a more desirable and ultimately more rich, more wealthy, more white, more elite state. So when I was first actually exposed to placemaking, it was when I was living in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and there was an intersection in my neighborhood there had been a car accident there, and it was sort of a four-way stop. And a couple of people in the community had said, like, maybe we could do one of those paint the street and do like some traffic calming painting on the road. And these couple of people took that idea to the city and were able to get funding. And that sort of launched this larger community consultation that then sort of culminated in this big street party where people from all over the neighborhood could actually come together and paint the street. And in the process sort of decided on imagery. At the time, there had been a big debate about whether or not people could have backyard chickens in the neighborhood. And it was historically an area that was underfunded and had become quite run down in the process. And sort of as people were moving into the area, concerns about things like having chickens in the yard, which had previously not been an issue, sort of came up. And so in the design for placemaking around Black Street in Halifax that I'm talking about, you started to see things like chicken motifs coming into the actual design. And when I moved to Ontario, what I saw in placemaking was much more a city identifying an area as underused, identifying it as having potential to do something more for the sort of progress they envisioned for that city, and sort of prescribing it with placemaking by hiring and paying a trained professional artist, for example, as is what happened in Gowdy's Lane, to paint a mural on the walls. And then that mural doesn't actually show, it's sort of like these geometric patterns, doesn't reflect anything necessarily about that community or place, but then is actually taken and put in the cover of their BIA magazine and put a logo over it that says Downtown Kitchener, and OWN and IT are singled out as letters, so own it. And I thought this is really interesting because, and concerning more than interesting, because on the outside, if you don't know how this came to be, it looks a lot like placemaking. It's masquerading. But what it actually is absolutely... it's like late stage gentrification, and moving the city towards becoming more exclusive rather than inclusive. So I was concerned, and still am concerned, about the ways placemaking is co-opted, and also recognized that even in the case of that more participatory process, there's still the potential for that to really brand the neighborhood as belonging to certain types of people. So even then, the representation in the Halifax example, absolutely, that was a gentrifying neighborhood at that time. So then in reflecting on that, I recognized like all of this is potentially quite problematic and exclusionary, and ultimately serves to erase and subsume some histories of a place in favor of this more socially desirable and more marketable approach.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that kind of was coming up, I first saw Robin present on anti-gentrification when I asked her to come into the course I teach on leisure and liberation. And she did this amazing presentation that really highlighted a lot of what she was talking about. And one of the things after that presentation, I think, Robin, we had a kind of conversation about the ways that in talking about placemaking or revitalization, and gentrification, there was often the discussion of original inhabitants. And we, at the same time, had been reading into a lot of settler colonialism and thinking to ourselves, what in the world does original inhabitants mean if we're not actually speaking of indigeneity and settler colonialism as we think through gentrification? And so then I think that is kind of what led us to thinking about a lot of different topics that are coming up in the things that we're reading already that really all pull together to create a much more complex view of gentrification. So, you know, as Robin notes in the paper, things like settler colonialism, systemic racism,
socioeconomic elitism,
abolitionism, all yeah. these things really coming together to articulate a very different starting point of our conversations around gentrification, because how can we even speak of it without speaking of actually whose land we stole as settlers?
Yeah, and in the paper you do choose to speak and talk through a little bit of the history of Gowdy's Lane and to sort of situate its changing nature. Can you share a little bit about that and how in your work you saw that the site was covered in local media?
We struggled, I think, to write the case of Gowdy's Lane. And I think it initially did sort of start as a case study. And then in sort of building off what Liz just said about talking about original inhabitants. So that's language that's in like the very definitions of gentrification. Like a place is considered gentrified when all of the quote unquote original inhabitants are displaced. So what does that mean when you're telling a history of somewhere? Where do you choose as a starting place? And so as we sort of worked through kind of familiarizing ourselves with ourselves with Gowdy's Lane, we ended up ultimately having to call it a partial case. And I think maybe I can just read a section here. We said, what does it mean to articulate a piece of land that is perpetually unhistoried? To write a history of something still in process, to write a case of a particular land is often to position that narration through the frame of settler colonialism. Determining which details matter also reinforces which aspects are worthy of being perpetuated in systems that create hierarchies of worth based on oppressive histories and presence. Any settler storying, from our position, is always already a colonizing mechanism. And we draw on Eve Tuck, Allison Guest, and Hannah Salton in saying, so we write instead, and we're quoting them here, we write to you from the middle of something. It may not really be the middle, but it's not the end and it's not the beginning. And we said it only tells what needs to be told for its partial history to lend itself to activating change. At best, this is a partial case of Gowdy's Lane. So we did trace some of the history of Gowdy's Lane back to sort of periods where Kitchener was thriving economically, and also periods where there was sort of what was characterized as a trough of decline, recession, a lot of job loss, and also connecting that to suburbanization of the area. So like patterns of where people are living and how they're engaging with the city, leading to it either being really desirable or incentivized and monetized by the government, or being undesirable and falling into disrepair, and sort of following some of those tensions through Gowdy's Lane, but simultaneously subverting that story, because that's assuming the starting place is already after colonization, and colonization is ongoing and enduring. So it was complicated and hard to sort of choose how to approach being descriptive and describing what we're seeing around us unfolding, and also allowing for multiple histories to unfold together.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the things we really wanted to make sure to include there was the recognition that this lane in so-called Kitchener, as we say so-called, with the idea that even that naming is in itself a colonialist mechanism, is that the very land we're talking about were promised to the Six Nations of the Grand River peoples. So it's within the traditional territories of the neutral Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee peoples. And so we need to acknowledge that these are peoples who are still living in the area, that are still alive and present. It's not a history of an area, but a reality of what's going on currently, and that needs to be brought to the forefront of our talking about histories of land, not as something that is ending or over, but something that's still in process and in moving towards something different. And I think a lot of what we wanted to really think about were whose voices aren't being brought into the rooms when we're thinking about revitalization of spaces. It's not only to say that it's enough to have liberatory voices in the rooms, but that question of, and I was telling Rob, and I was reading some of Femi Taiwo talking about we have to leave certain rooms, and we have to actually think about building new rooms and building them differently with different voices and different people. So I think that's something too that we were thinking about when we were talking, as Robin was saying, about who makes the mural, what does the mural represent, that even some of the most important decisions being made in, there's an assumption that they're making them in very liberatory ways. The question still remains, whose voices are missing? Who is not in that room to state their claim? And who are we ignoring as something that's a historical thing versus something that's happening in the current moment?
Yeah, and I know that your body of research doesn't usually center Kitchener or Waterloo region necessarily. So why did it feel important to engage your history at the site of Gowdy's Lane even as a partial case?
We haven't talked about this paper in so long. And even if we reread it to think through what we're going to say for this interview, we realize how many things we would talk about differently, about how many different things that we have engaged with, taken up, learned from, listened about, failed at in the last even month would actually completely reconsider how we might talk about things in this paper and think through things with this paper. So while our work doesn't necessarily house itself in Kitchener-Waterloo, I think much of what our work always does is taking up these different ideas and these different theories and these different people that we're in conversation with, whether that be somebody who's published or someone that we're just engaging with as friends or family or community, and really think about what makes sense of thinking through in our own lives with those things that we're in conversation with. And I think at this moment, Robin and I both were feeling a bit displaced in Kitchener-Waterloo, coming from I was coming from Memphis, Tennessee, and Robin was coming from Halifax, and had ideas of what this college town might be like that were not necessarily what we actually were rubbing up against when we first got here. And I think, you know, I was just joking with Robin, I think the lane was just like a very physical in-your-face manifestation of some of the other displacements we were seeing or even feeling as we tried to build and make space for ourselves and our families in the communities of Kitchener-Waterloo that themselves sometimes could feel like walls.
Yeah, that's well put. I think that's absolutely it. Like we both did spend some time living and of course still working out of a university based in that area. And it, Gowdy's Lane, I think, to me, I remember thinking about it as like, this is the icon of what placemaking and gentrification look like. From the Edison, strings of Edison bulbs. I remember like when Elizabeth and I were first talking about it, I was like, they're the harbingers of gentrification. So sort of how you know it's coming, the spectre. And so it wasn't so much a big interest in actually doing longer term anti-gentrification work in KW, because to be quite honest, I found it hard to be motivated to do that there because the gentrification was so progressed and so late stage. It's just an example, I think, of everything that can go wrong with the place. And that's not to say there's not wonderful anti-gentrification work being done there or pockets of community and resilience and resistance. But for me, it was a way of drawing attention to the co-opting of placemaking for the status quo.
Yeah, and I really like how you both have, you know, been chatting about your relationality as academics and like the way that your research and community interests are all sort of braided together. And so in speaking to this, what are some connections between leisure studies and placemaking that maybe people aren't thinking about as they're you know, going out for recreation or in leisure? And how can we bring that to people more upfront and for them to consider it in their work?
I feel like our field is a very positive field. So we're quick to really look at, and maybe this makes me sort of a killjoy to draw on Sarah Ahmed, but we're quick to really celebrate the goods. And then often just name, in leisure studies specifically, often just name sort of these concerns I had that were so glaring as a cautionary afterthought. So it's like, look at all these wonderful things this place can do, but also it might be exclusionary. And that's sort of a default orientation in lots of areas of leisure studies, not just related to placemaking. In particular, I think because leisure studies has a lot of overlap with health and wellness. And also we can sort of legitimize our field. We're small. We're not planners. Or we may be from previous degrees, but if we're situated in leisure studies, I think there's a big push to see the inherent goods in a place. And so I was called ultimately to push back and offer counter narratives to that.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think leisure studies and leisure in general, when you tell people you study it, quite often they laugh as though it's not an object of serious inquiry. When we think about the relevance it has in so many of our lives in terms of the relation to capitalism, the relation to racism, to homophobism, I mean, leisure is not a space that is somehow devoid of all the injustices and inequities we see everywhere else. And in fact, because it's assumed to be so at times, it actually becomes a bit more of a dangerous space because it does seem to glorify at times individualism and this idea that we've earned this by some wage labor to experience leisure and therefore we can just do whatever we want in it, without the recognition that it is a precarious sphere, just like any other space that we live in and engage in. And so I think, unfortunately, in an attempt at times to make leisure relevant or feel that it is worthy of study, one of the ways that historically it's been done is to show a benefits-based model of all the great things leisure can do for us. And I think more recently, especially as our field is really infiltrated with, you know, Black radicalisms, Black radicalisms, abolition geographies, indigenous traditional knowledges or anti-colonialist decolonizing theories, that we really start to look at the ways that leisure in itself is also a problem. Like what leisure can do can create very negative consequences. And this is where I think Robin and I really thought about gentrification and the ways that some of the very first kind of manifestations of gentrification have to do with leisure. It's the park that now, in order to play on it, you have to join a league, whereas before you could just simply use it and engage with it freely. It's the mom and pop shops that are being shut down for dog grooming or for particular, you know, types of leisure that are fairly elitist and or expensive. And so when we start to think of leisure not as the only way it's used is to beautify or revitalize and in critiquing of both of those processes at the same time, but that it's actually a mechanism that can come in very innocuously because of people's perception of it and begin gentrification processes that displace and set up certain and particular types and certain kind of sanctioned ways of thinking about what humans can do in with their leisure, which I think Robin might really lead into talking a little bit about the ways that we start to then see these spaces used for both, you know, well-being, but also for resistance. And we talked about that a little bit in the paper.
Yeah. So, for example, in Gowdy's Lane, one of the things that was interesting to me is had I arrived in Kitchener a few years prior and saw this myself as a derelict lot and identified that as a new arrival to Kitchener, had I spent some time in the alley and perhaps took it upon myself to paint a mural, whether it was with tempera paints or spray paints or whatever, it's possible that I could have been ticketed for that and gotten in some legal trouble. And in particular, that risk is not the same for everyone, right? So I'm a white body in that space. The likelihood that I actually would be tried for some vandalism, I don't know, but we do know that that risk goes up for other people who were using that space prior to it being seen as quote unquote derelict or underused. So just the idea of sort of who gets to actually act upon a space and what does that look like? So vandalism, you could say, is actually another type of placemaking or unmaking. You're directly changing an area and taking some control into your own hands. And that takes really different forms. It's not always breaking windows and spray paint. It could actually be guerrilla gardening. So saying, I want to put some wood down here and some soil, and I'm going to, until they kick me off this lot, I'm going to farm it and feed my community. but these aren't sanctioned activities ultimately. And so who gets to say what is an acceptable use or underuse of an area, and who gets to say, you know, this needs to be beautified with a mural and we're going to pay someone, you know, a professional, however many thousands of dollars to do that. That was concerning to me, because ultimately it serves to continue giving the most powerful the most power and the most money to ultimately influence what a city is and who it's for.
So why was this work important to you? You know, you've both kind of spoken to some motivations that brought you into this work, and we are a bit of a university town, and I'm really keen to hear what this process taught you about the researcher-community relationship.
Yeah, so I think one of the things we see in gentrification research, and I'm part of this too, I did my master's research in Halifax about gentrification, and absolutely talked to people who were experiencing gentrification, but there's a rush to sort of gather the perspectives of folks who are being negatively impacted. And that rush is not always met with meaningful intent or will or ability, unfortunately, to actually enact change. And so in that case, what ends up happening is an extraction of stories and a lot of trauma narratives, I would say, because gentrification is absolutely traumatic, without a lot of backup in terms of what can I actually do with my power and position as a researcher, as a grad student, to address some of those harms. And some of this is because I think for a long time, gentrification was problematically studied from the perspective of the newcomers. So because it was hard to capture perspectives of folks who were displaced, there was a period of time where gentrification research weirdly foregrounded the experiences of newcomers. And through that process, one of British geographer Loretta Lees sort of critiqued that and called attention to it. But in turn, now we have a lot of gentrification research that stories the harms, and the harms are so well documented that I don't know whether that was sort of a repository that I wanted to build to without being able to actually meaningfully enact some change. And I knew that my ability to actually do anything about the state of Gowdy's Lane, for example, if I went into the community and people said, like, I don't feel included or represented there at all, I don't know that that's what people would have said because they didn't do that work. But I was concerned about my limited influence. So instead, what Lisbeth and I often talk about are like, what skill sets or resources or funding or time, labor time, do we have that we can extract from the university and use as a tool towards liberation, towards the types of communities and worlds and worldings that matter to us?
Yeah, and I think that this was just the perfect time, because I was teaching a course and we were talking about abolition and Black radicalism, and I had read some work by the Abolition Collective, and there was a line in it. At the time, I was thinking to myself, what am I doing in academia? And the line in it basically says something to the nature of, we can't leave the resources of the university to those who simply perpetuate status quo. And so it really started to frame and reframe the ways I was thinking about scholarship and research. And as I was reading that, Robin was doing this great work. And I think what happened was we really came together to say, what can we do differently in terms of building community and researcher relations in a way that, instead of extracting from people that are outside of the university, we actually take up the resources of the university, including our own skill sets and privileges, and extract them for the use by people in the community who are already doing these kinds of work. And we have another colleague of ours, Marcus Pereira, and then Jen Baptiste, that we kind of connected with, and they happen to be organizing for anti-gentrification in Little Jamaica with a group called Reclaim Rebuild Eglinton West. And so we asked them if they would have any interest in basically hiring us through a grant to help support the work that they're already doing on anti-gentrification within their neighborhood. And this was really the start of, I think, all of us really thinking about coalitional politics as a methodology for research, whether or not we even need to call it research or methodology. It only needs those words because of the attachment to academia. But I do think that that's kind of the ways that this paper and the ways of thinking through this paper has really helped us to reframe as we also read kind of abolitionist work and Black radicalisms and in often actually some of the Eve Tuck that we've mentioned in our paper, different Indigenous scholars. And also listening to like Laurie Campbell and Amy Smoke in our own university, thinking about how we can do research differently and build relations and how that relationality has got to be at the forefront as we move towards coalitional politics as a form of research.
So I've learned a bit about placemaking and placekeeping, you know, whereas placekeeping does include that active care and maintenance of a community by the people who live there and work there and preserves that cultural memory that is associated with the place that sometimes, you know, a bit of a refurbishment can sort of erase. And so what actions have been emerging for you in supporting a sort of caretaking approach to placemaking? And what would you suggest for listeners to think about when they're moving through these spaces?
So I think the goal of placekeeping, which is something I'm still just learning about, but ultimately is geared towards maintaining and preserving cultural meanings and connections. And so that's not sort of romanticizing or museumifying indigeneity, but actually looking at where are Indigenous folks in this city right now, what matters, what's needed, and how can that be promoted over the sort of unquenchable need for capitalist progress. So it's a shift in priorities. It's a shift in what the starting place is, but it's also a shift in what the goal is and who's involved and who has control. And so placekeeping also requires that people with power meaningfully relegate some of that power. And that's really important to happen. And then in terms of what people can think about, because it is also a university town, it's a really transient space. And something I often think about is that every time you move, the restriction on how much rent can go up in a particular place, for example, changes. So there's a call for folks to increasingly stay put and try to be less transient as one small choice. But I also, so these are sort of the sort of usual tips and tricks for anti-gentrification, not just in relation to placemaking, but in general. And I struggle with them because they also shift responsibility onto individual consumptive choices when, and they are good intentioned and may have positive effect, but ultimately don't do that meaningful let go of power that needs to happen for placekeeping to happen. So sort of shifting actually how we think about it and who has control and stewardship of land and place and who defines what a place is. It's a big shift, a departure from our current way of thinking through things. So instead of looking at, for example, if this is a place I want to preserve, how can I apply for funding and get a grant so that we can do the mural ourselves? Instead of taking that approach and using the systems and powers that be to sort of further my cause, I would instead look at like, do I know my neighbors? Do I know which of my neighbors might be most hungry tonight? Are there ways I can care for my community that don't involve actually necessarily changing anything, but just enhancing our localized connections? Is there a tenant union? Am I part of it? So place-based connections don't necessarily require beautification. And I think this is something we are quick to dismiss. So places that are ugly or written about as dead and dying often don't get the same attention, but you can have a strong sense of place and a lot of meaningful community in those spaces. So also to sort of slow our rush to progress, slow our rush to quote unquote improvement and beautification, and look at, and it's perhaps more an asset-based approach too, right? To look at what's actually going on in my community, what are the meaningful needs, and where am I in relation to those, and how can I actually care for people, feed people, help them navigate filing a grievance against their landlord, help them navigate childcare, receive those same supports when I need them. Absolutely. So that's the idea of mutual aid. So ultimately, building community without the rush to progress and beautification and gentrification, and ultimately hoping that those things galvanize in this sort of staying put, because it's harder to move away when we have those connections.
Is there anything else that we haven't maybe covered in these questions that you want to chat about or you want our listeners to know?
If anything, just the recognition that the we speak through is always already complicit in lots of these acts of gentrification that we're speaking of. And so it's not that we can disentangle ourselves from what's going on or pretend that we stand above or beside or aside from it, but rather that there's a need to be accountable and to recognize our complicity and to really start to think differently about the starting points of our research and focus on relations and building community through what often prior in many years has been a more extracting process. So not to deny the fact that we ourselves are complicit, but to recognize and hold that as intention as we move forward.
Check out the archive versions of this program and other episodes on radiowaterloo.ca/news and follow us on Twitter at Radio Waterloo. You can email news@radiowaterloo.ca to get in touch with comments or ideas about stories to cover.